In episode 38 of MobiCast, we discuss when and when not to use open source libraries in your projects. Welcome to MobiCast, a weekly conversation about containerization, Docker, and modern software deployment. Let's jump right in.
Welcome, Chris and Rich.
Hey, guys.
Hey, John.
Hey, another episode of MobiCast. So, Rich, what have you been up to last week?
So we are about to upgrade our servers to PHP 7, which shouldn't be a big deal, but we have almost 100 different websites that we manage on our servers, and all of them
That's
are
a few. Yeah.
And all of them are using A records, right, to point to the IP address. And so now all of these will have to be updated. And the problem, of course, is that we don't have the credentials for GoDaddy or whatever is their domain manager. So I'm preparing this for January 15th because I know that if I send out the email, it'll take a month and a half for everyone to actually. We do this once a year, I feel like. Unfortunately, this upgrade requires an IP address change. And so it's just a nightmare. In addition to that, we're also like, well, if we're going to do this too, then maybe we should, you know, our version control is now in Beanstalk. And we're moving everything to GitHub private. And so now I have to move 200 probably repos because we have the theme that's versioned and then the core functionality plugin. So a lot of like really, really meticulous, boring, just slog work.
Migration hell. Yeah, sounds good. Good luck.
Yeah.
How about you, Chris? What are you up to?
I just kind of busy with the normal routine. This is always kind of a busy time of year as we head into the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. So trying to get some projects done and a couple trips, travel trips coming up, arranging for that, and lamenting the change of weather now too as well. So not being able to get outside as often. And so I'm just trying to come to mental terms with that.
I'm having the same difficulty. Yeah, this week it's rare that I have to do much in the way of business work or negotiation other than you know, with new projects. But this week we ran across a client that was maybe wanting us to push harder than we normally do and give up some weekends and family time kind of thing. And so in order to do that, I was looking at ways of you know, evening the risk reward ratio that happens on our side for that. I would call it a fire drill basically. And then it ended up not needing to happen. So lots of stress and hard work for then just going back to normal. I think if that had actually happened, we wouldn't be talking right now. We would have had to skip this episode of MobiCast. So I'm glad it didn't happen. And this week, I think we're going to talk about using open source libraries, SDKs, open source, just pieces of code that you can put into your own stuff that you build. And it's a very, very broad topic and we only have 20 minutes. But we just have some opinions about it and we've been around, from the time when there wasn't much that people were using to now where there's, you know, there can almost be not much of your own code in a fully functioning application, and mostly everything is open source. So yeah, let's jump in. And I think your career history, I just want to hear from your perspective how you see that, you know, just kind of give a couple highlights of when you started seeing open source getting used a lot and how your attitude has changed about it over the past several years, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, being an old timer in this game, I definitely did witness the transformation and the emergence of open source. So that was, you know, early 2000, 2000, yeah. So 2000, 2001, 2002, where it really started to kind of take root. And the whole idea of just open source as a community, there was a couple books written about the subject. I think The Cathedral and the Bazaar, I believe, is one of the ones that was pretty popular at that time to kind of like, it was like basically at that time, like you said, open. So it was kind of like the Bitcoin of its era in a way. Right? It was the technology buzz term at that time. Because it was so new. And it was kind of like this really.
And that controversial maybe too, huh? Like people had strong opinions for and against.
Well, remember, I mean, up until that point, like software was something you paid for, right? Mm-hmm. And like, this is the big linchpin of just Microsoft, right? Its whole, the beginnings of that company and its core philosophy, right? Like,
right.
Software was an asset. It was to be fiercely protected by the company, and people paid for it. And if you didn't pay for that software, if you got it by copying it from someone else and you didn't pay for it, they would go after you. Like, and they were very much going to protect themselves against that. Right. And so, and that was true with, you know, most of the other companies as well. I mean, the only, at that point, I think things like Unix, basically software coming out of the universities, was like, the equivalent of open source software, but it was really just like big pieces of software, right? It was like operating systems or compilers. It really wasn't libraries at that point. So it was, this was a very big, radical change, philosophical change for the industry. But it definitely, you know, obviously it caught fire, and people realized, you know what, like there's something nice about this, about having a community where people can leverage each other, they can share, and we can get a lot more done by working together as opposed to make everyone pay for everything that we do.
Right. And when I started my career, it was like, boom, here we are. Open source starts today. Like you graduate going to become a professional software developer. And like that very day is like, hey, there's this Linux thing. Like, you should try installing it on this machine. And it's like 2 days later, I did it, but none of the drivers work. So, exactly when I was kind of starting to decide what software was all about in terms of a professional career is exactly when this was happening. And I'm sure you and I probably touched the same open source projects to begin with. Linux, obviously, at first, and then probably Apache, and then maybe, I don't know if you ever touched JBoss, Tomcat type stuff. But that was kind of
unfortunately, I like to forget that part of my career.
But then, then a few years later, it's like along comes, you know, I think that one of the next big things to happen was, you know, there were obviously libraries, jar files that you could, that were open source that you could include in your Java projects. But the next really big leap forward was probably Ruby, Rails, and that community, Gems. And I don't know that you delved much into that world at that time in your career. Were you playing much with open source and getting involved in any of those communities?
No, you know, I'm going back. I mean, I was very much a Microsoft fan. I worked there for a while, and kind of definitely cut my teeth on that tech stack. So, around the time that Ruby was kind of gaining hold and starting to get some adoption, I was still pretty much into the Microsoft stack. So .NET, still in that space. So
right on.
And there was some open source stuff in that
sure.
space, but not nearly as much. I mean, there was like no package manager for .NET. There is now. I mean, there eventually did become one, but. Yeah.
Well, it's that sort of mentality that started to take hold in the Ruby world that has only increased since then, that we really want to get at today. Because in the Ruby world was the first time you just saw every little thing, anything, you know, throw it on GitHub. I guess it wasn't even GitHub at the time, but throw it somewhere. I'm trying to remember the name, rubygems.org or something. Throw it there and let other people use it. And it could be, you know, something as big as an ORM. Or for mapping objects to relational tables in your database, to a little widget, you know, just a tiny little text box with a special feature, and people were just grabbing gems, and you would see Ruby projects with 20, 30, 50, 70, 150 gems in them, and now almost everything, you know, the whole world has kind of moved over to JavaScript and Node and React and I think it's only increased. What would you say, Chris? Like, has that been your first real, like, I know you did some work in using Python, but you're also deeply involved in JavaScript and using JavaScript to write production code. Has that been kind of the place where you've seen the most action in libraries and available things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that NPM probably is like the biggest repository for packages. So it really, you know, like I said, kind of Rails, I think, definitely was before Node. It started, it kind of had this concept, and it I don't think it had its own repository, right? I think it was just other things sprang up around it to do so. And, you know, I forget what the numbers are, but it was kind of like, you know, after a few years, there was like 25,000 packages like in the Rails community type thing. Node came on the scene, I think, in 2009, 2010. And pretty soon after Node was built, that's when it was like, hey, we need a package manager for this. So let's go ahead and build NPM to do so. And it just, for whatever reasons, you know, Node took off, and the whole concept of having this reusable code as packages took off. And so NPM itself grew very, very quickly. And so I've seen the charts before where it shows the adoption of like modules that are available for Node versus Rails, like how long it took NPM to get to the same size as Rails. It's compressed by a 3x, time, right? So, and I know now it's just ungodly numbers. It's like, you know, billions of packages downloads, you know, a month type thing from NPM.
Right.
It's really exploding.
And this conversation is about to take a hard left turn, but before it does, I just want to say that I myself even remember somewhere around 2010 or 11, just having an argument with somebody who was a bit of a programming language purist, and trying to argue with me about some technical benefit of whatever it was that they were using. Maybe it was Scala. I can't remember. About why I should be thinking about that and using that instead of, at the time, I was using Ruby. And I argued back pretty fiercely at that time. I specifically remember this conversation, just saying, you know, you have no idea what you're saying. It doesn't matter that the, you know, these esoteric technology improvements that in the language you're talking about exist, because I can accomplish the same business work in the language that I'm using, and the community around it is so much more powerful. And that community is really the future of software development. I just remember having that argument and feeling so right. I was like, yes, this is what it is all about. Now is where we take the hard left turn. I still do think that that's important, but I think that there can maybe be too much of a good thing. And I think that, that's what we're going to talk about kind of for the rest of this conversation, is where is that line? Where is the balance between overusing open source and using just the right amount of open source? Yeah. Chris, let's talk about what we see among people that are sort of still more early in their careers, as they, you know, they've graduated with a degree, or they've come through a bootcamp, or they've got maybe 2 or 3 years of experience being a developer. What do we typically see in terms of their relationship with open source?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, it's like, it's kind of always been there for them, right? Like, haven't known a time where it wasn't there. And so it's kind of like just taking it for granted. Like, it's just part of the software code base. And so definitely see the, I guess, just implicit trust. Like, just, you know, like, hey, if I can go find something that does what it is that I need to do, just go ahead and use it. I'm done, right? Like, this is great. And now I can basically build software by just gluing things together, you know, kind of like a Lego approach, right? Just stacking these, just attaching these blocks together type thing.
Exactly. Yep.
And
so it's sort of the default behavior. Feature X. Oh, let me go Google it. Does it exist as an open source project? Okay, done. Wow. Now I can move on to feature Y.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, again, the open source community is great, and there is so much good work that's being done there, that has been done there. It's like, it's impossible.
We want to be careful about it, because because what we're saying is a little controversial, right? So we want to make sure we it's very obvious that we're pro open source. But yeah, go ahead.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not even possible to build software today without without the open source community. I mean, and to build modern software for like the cloud, right? Like it's just, it'd be really hard to write it without leveraging like some just core pieces of just software that has been open sourced or
right. And it would be wrong from a business perspective, right? You would be spending
value
that you shouldn't be.
Yep, absolutely. So it's definitely it's an important part of this foundational piece, but it's you also it's a double-edged sword too, right? Because it's like you need to be thinking about just a whole bunch of particular facets, criteria as you decide to go use this software. Like, what does that actually mean? Like, you're now trusting code that was written by someone else. You probably are not even looking at the code, and it's you've now sucked it up into your project, and for all intents and purposes, it's now your code base, and you are now really responsible for maintaining that and for, making sure that that has high fidelity and integrity.
Hey, this is Rich. Please pardon this quick interruption. We recently passed an internal milestone of 10,000 listens, and I wanted to take a moment to thank you for the support. I was also hoping to encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a review or a rating. Positive feedback and constructive criticism are both incredibly important to us. So give us an idea of how we're doing, and we'll promise to keep publishing new episodes every week. All right, let's dive back in.
Chris, before we started this conversation, we were kind of planning, and you said, would you use this code is this as good as the code that you would write? Like, would you consider it your own? And when you said that, the warning bell that went off in me is, I think a lot of people, especially in their first, let's say 5 years of work, they may assume that any other code is better than their code. There may be just a confidence issue, right? So, if it's on the web and it's in GitHub, it's probably better than anything I would write. So let me just use that. That way I can trust it because mine is not trustworthy. And so I think we need to break that. That's not okay to assume that all other code is better than anything you would write yourself, right? Like, you know your own problems, like what your customers want, what the rest of your application is doing. Give yourself some credit. Your code is not default bad code. So don't assume that open source code is better than yours always.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, if you have any experience whatsoever, with writing code, if you've been doing it for any amount of time and studying the craft, studying the material, like you should have some pretty good thoughts, right? And you should have some base level of confidence. And even if you are new, I mean, you just by looking at the code, you can be learning from it. And I mean, there's nothing to say that you won't see something, a way to improve it, right? So I think being inexperienced is no excuse for not being able to take at least a critical look at something and decide whether or not like, does this feel good? And you could even, being more inexperienced, it doesn't necessarily have to be like, I'm going to go evaluate the efficiency of this function and the way that it was developed. And, is it really the best algorithm? Like, you can pop up a few levels and say like, hey, this piece of open source software that I'm bringing in, like, does it have unit test? Does it have, exactly. Is it commented accordingly? Are the files laid out in a way that, makes it easy to kind of understand like what it's doing and how it's organized, right? I mean, those are all things that don't require a lot of experience.
If it's in GitHub, does it have lots of issues? Do they look like they're getting attention? How many other people are using it?
Exactly. So I don't think it matters. Like whether you're inexperienced or you've been, a seasoned veteran, when you're looking at adopting some piece of open source code, you need to make that a considered decision, right? Mm-hmm. Because you essentially are saying like, whatever code you've written, I'm now bringing it into my own project. And I should treat it with the same kind of, you know, respect and concerns that I would have for code written by a fellow colleague, right, on my team or myself.
Right. So what would you typically want to use as open source? Like what would you, instead, so we've said what we typically see newer developers do is there an open source project for this feature that I'm about to do? Okay, there is, I'm going to pull it in. Instead of having that be the default mode, what do you think is a better default mode? And it can't be like, I'm going to make a very considered, well-researched, just, you know, it's got to be a little bit more easily digestible sort of MO or sort of like way of going about making this decision than something that could lead to analysis paralysis. Like I don't want to suggest that everybody gets into analysis paralysis. So how do we tell people when they should go look for open source?
Yeah, I think for most projects, you have like this, like a core set of just fundamental open source projects that make sense for you to leverage. And you can do that without really thinking twice about it. So like if you're in writing Node code, like things like Express or Winston or something like SQLize, if you're working with relational databases or the official the Redis library, obviously the AWS SDK module, like these are all just like fundamental things that you just, they're being dependent upon by, you know, millions of other pieces of code. They're getting millions of downloads. There's lots of eyes being looked on this stuff. Like you don't even really think twice about it. And that's, you should not be writing that type of code anyhow, right? Like this mm-hmm. is the kind of code you can depend upon. And you should leverage that. So I think, you know, just about every, and regardless of what platform you're on, whether you're Node or Rails or Go or Python, they're all going to have their equivalent, like just foundational frameworks,
yes.
libraries, right, that they depend upon. So, you know, and so, but that should be relatively small. I mean, you're probably on the order of maybe like 5 to 10 like libraries or frameworks that would fall into that category. Then after that, you get into something that becomes much more application specific. And those, again, now these are where you start making considered choices, right? And you definitely want to, I mean, I'm very much a believer, like the fewer dependencies that you have, the better off that you're going to be. So if you can, it's just a trade-off, right? Of like how, you know, if you do have a library out there, an open source library that does exist, you know, mostly or exactly what it is that you need done, and it's an appreciable amount of work to go duplicate it, then, you know, it makes sense for you to go and look at that and say like, hey, should I bring this in? Like, let me vet it. If you're looking at something like I need to do, I don't know, like something like iteration over an array that can deal with null values, like, mm-hmm. like that's not a package, right? Like go write the 3 lines of code right. and make it your own package, you know, type thing.
I want to say like there's got to be like a rule of thumb, like is it going to save me at least 3 days or at least a week or something? If you feel like if I could do this, I could not write code for a week, I mean, then it maybe feels like worth at least exploring.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on too, like on just like where you're at, you know, in your career and how much experience you have. I would actually kind of like default to like the less experienced you are, the bigger that time frame should be. Mm-hmm. To say like, yeah. Right. So,
because
like,
if you have more experience, then you're going to be able to better take a look at the package and say, is this well written or not?
Mm-hmm. And not only that,
like, all right, I'll save the 5 hours because this is great or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Not only that, it's just like as an inexperienced person, like the only way to get more experienced and better at coding is like by writing code. Mm-hmm. And if you, instead of writing the code, you're just bringing in someone else's code, then you miss that opportunity. Right.
Yeah. So. Yep. And I want to add that this is like one of the best reasons to not use open source is to hide the complexity of something that is generally expected that developers will use. And I just have to tell a personal story. I made this mistake myself on a project that I was working on with you. So you were working for the client and I was working for Kelsis. And this was about at least like 8 years ago, probably. And I was writing some, or maybe not, maybe six, but anyway, I was writing some iOS code, and I knew I needed to persist some stuff on the client and have that get synced up to some data on the server, that, and you were writing some APIs for that. And, you know, I was coming off the heels of doing a lot of work in Rails, and there was a framework that somebody had written that was getting a lot of attention that kind of made writing iOS code feel sort of Railsy. And I was like, oh, I got to try that. That sounds great. And it just ended up not being great. It was just the worst POS I have ever dealt with. And I remember asking you, can you reformat the JSON this way and that way? Like, cause I was just dealing with limitations in the library. And really, what I was trying to avoid is that iOS still to this day has this fairly complicated, persistence API called Core Data. And especially at that time, you really had to understand the threading model around Core Data, or you could just ruin applications. And the threading model was not, it was sophisticated. It was multiple weeks of study in order to become proficient with it. And I just was like, oh, I can use this library, and then I don't have to learn that because it'll take care of it for me. Well, guess who ended up learning the library eventually and getting rid of that? That's a stupid freaking framework. Me, it was like, sorry, client, I've got to start over. I literally started that application over again. Mm-hmm. I'm not lesson the hard way. So don't make that mistake. Learn the libraries.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just quickly, like some other heuristics or criteria that I look at when deciding whether or not to use an open source module, you know, look at things like, you know, how many other folks are using it. Like if it's on a GitHub repo, like how many stars does it have? How many other, dependent applications that it has? Consider who wrote it as well. Like, I mean, there are well-known folks in the community. So obviously, you know, if it's someone that has an established name for themselves and a great track record that you know about, that's going to lend more credence, should give that more weight. I mean, that doesn't mean that, folks that don't have that, that history or that background doesn't exclude them, but it's just like, it's obviously bonus points. If it's someone that has a track record that you can look at the commit history too, as well, right? Like how, when was the last time this thing was updated, right? Is it 3 years old? Was it 4 years old since the last commit? Then, you know, that's going to be something that's a bit of a code smell. You know, you may want to think twice, three times, four times about whether or not you pull that in. Like I said, look at the code itself, right? Is the code clean? Is it, can you understand like what it's doing? Is it laid out well? Does it have unit tests, or does it have the appropriate comments? Look at things like that to give you an idea of the overall quality of it. And then, you know, you can obviously look at things like, you know, issues. Like, are there a lot of issues? Paradoxically, it's kind of, I think the more issues something has, it kind of usually indicates like it's actually something you can rely upon for the most part, as long as they're not just sitting there and they're just stacking up, right? Usually things that have lots of issues means that there's lots of people using it. So if it has like 70 open issues, it might mean that there's a million people using it, right? Or
agreed. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyhow, those are some of the things I think you should look at when deciding whether to use some open source software.
Cool. Well, I think that basically paints a pretty clear picture. Hopefully some folks are listening to this and adjust accordingly. Don't save yourself 2 hours. Do the learning and use the solid packages, the ones that really are useful.
Yeah, and you know, one other thing to definitely make sure you leverage is like, so security is definitely, it's a big issue.
Oh, security, yes.
Right? Yeah. This is software out there that anyone can write, right? Like they can do whatever they want. Like you can have like node modules that they get access to the file system. They can write whatever they want, read and write. Mm-hmm. So, you know, security is a big issue. But there's lots of tools out there in the communities to kind of help with this, right? So recently, like in the node community, there was actually an independent company that was doing security evaluations and kind of like just certifying modules as being clean. And then NPM bought that company, and now it's actually just part of NPM. So you can just do an NPM audit run that command, and that will go and scan for any known vulnerabilities in the packages that you're using. There's other scanning solutions out there as well that do this. They either go against like a CVE database or actually just at the application level as well. So definitely, like, that this is another big, huge consideration when using open source software, is just like, what are the security ramifications?
Right. You don't want the fancy text box that you got off of a React library putting a coin miner into a browser.
Yep. Indeed.
All right. Well, thanks so much for this conversation about open source and using libraries.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for putting this together, Rich.
Later.
Talk to you next time. Bye.
Well, dear listener, you made it to the end. We appreciate your time and invite you to continue the conversation with us online. This episode, along with show notes and other valuable resources, is available at mobicast.fm/38. If you have any questions or additional insights, we encourage you to leave us a comment there. Thank you. I will see you again next week.